All right, joining me on the line today is Grant Jeffery. He's an author, he's a speaker, a documentary filmmaker, and he's the chairman of Frontier Research Publications. He's authored a book entitled Shadow Government, How the Secret Elite is Using Surveillance Against You. Grant, thanks for coming on Follow the Money Weekly Radio.
Great to be with you, Jerry.
Grant, what is the shadow government that you've written about in your book? Talk about that. What is the shadow government?
Well, historically, those who have ruled us, whether they be kings or queens or presidents or prime ministers, have been front and center, and everyone in the country knows who they are, what they look like. But increasingly in our generation, the real political power that controls our lives is moving into the shadows. There's two basic reasons for that. One is national security, especially after 9/11. There's such a demand for national security that really citizens in the West have been asked to surrender their privacy and their freedom for the illusion of security that is being offered by the government and as a response to 9/11 especially. And what we have today is a great deal of governmental power that is in the shadows. It is not debated on the floors of Congress, that is not reported in the newspapers. A great number of the laws of the United States are issued by the president as executive orders, often not published and made any reference to in newspapers or magazines, and yet these laws have the force of congressional laws. In addition, we live in a world in which a government could disappear. Washington could be wiped out, or New York City with the financial center of the United States, in a moment, with weapons of mass destruction and terrorists who would love to do that, as 9/11 demonstrated. As a result, shadow government deals with the fact that most of the United States government's budget of over $30 billion that everyone thought was spent for FEMA for natural disasters such as Katrina, etc. Well, when we saw the real disaster in Katrina and the government was so inept in responding to that hurricane damage, one of the reasons I discovered is that 96% of all of that billions in the budget, over $30 billion, was not spent on preparing to deal with natural disasters. It was spent in what's known as continuity of government programs. 26 very large military governmental bases in the United States underground, where vast amounts of water and food are stored. Great numbers of soldiers as well as bureaucrats literally run a shadow government. For example, when President Obama was inaugurated on January 20th, 2 years ago, when that happened, there was every member of the Supreme Court, all the members of Congress, all the cabinet members, except one, was not there. Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, was not there. He was designated as the acting president of the United States if anything horrible had happened and a mass destruction attempt was made on Washington to wipe out the government in one fell swoop. He would have been placed in a base in Mount Weather in Virginia, in an underground base, where the continuity of government program runs a parallel backup to the Pentagon, to the financial systems of New York. Every 10 minutes, all the data is sent through coaxial cables to back up computers so that you would only lose at maximum 9 minutes of data if you lost the financial center of the United States. These programs are essential in a world in which there are weapons of mass destruction, suitcase nukes, and there are terrorists who would love nothing better than to do it. But it's a danger to the democracy because increasingly these continuity of government programs mean that at a future date, a dictatorially minded government could easily replace Congress and the Supreme Court and everything and act because these executive orders prepared for national emergencies allow the president to suspend the Constitution for 6 months and Congress cannot even vote on it and gives the president and all his officials authority over every part of the economy, over labor, over transportation, over the internet, and these kinds of things, I think, while you can argue are essential in a dangerous world, are obviously a danger.
You know, Grant, we've heard about this for the last century. We've heard about, you know, Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex. We heard, you know, Kennedy making allusions to this. And then finally, on September 11th, 2001, those tragic events that took place in New York City, we began to see Washington, the federal government, really begin to encroach upon the people. They began to move in just mass concert, and they began to create all these different acts and whatnot. Of course, Homeland Security came out of that. In your book, you spend some time talking about the overreach that has occurred as of 9/11. Why don't you go back to that day, talk about some of the impact that 9/11 had upon the what you call the shadow government?
Well, 9/11 gave the perfect excuse, though there was also reason behind it, for Congress to enact a number of emergency laws as well as the president's own executive orders that literally ramped up the government's ability to intrude in the lives of citizens, to utterly wipe out citizen privacy. You know, when you and I were growing up, you could take a walk down any street in your village or town or city, talk to your girlfriend, whisper in her ear, and have every reason to believe that nobody was trying to listen, that no one was trying to have surveillance on you, that if you are not a criminal or a terrorist, you had every reason to expect privacy. Well, that's simply no longer true. As I document in Shadow Government, the Project Echelon system was created after World War II, 1948, in fact. The five English-speaking victors of World War II, the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, got together and divided up the world and decided that they would monitor and record for permanent keeping every single conversation made by telephone, by fax, now by mobile and email and by internet surfing, all financial transactions anywhere in the world. They now know more about you than your mother or father do. The reality is, well, intelligence in the past historically went and sent James Bond types after a particular general or a bioweapons scientist. They decided with Echelon to do something different, and computers made it possible. There are simply not enough humans to listen to all these conversations. So what they do is they monitor them electronically with these supercomputers far faster than anything that can be bought by the civilian economy. These computers record with very inexpensive hard drive memory now. They record all these conversations. And using very sophisticated computer programs, they are monitoring them, looking for particular addresses, telephone numbers, bank account numbers. In the course of a conversation, you're calling your mother and talking about a movie you saw, and you mention White House and bomb and the president, I guarantee you that particular phone call will be downloaded by the computer automatically because of the use of those particular words.
So I guess this phone call we're having right now is going to be downloaded.
Oh, absolutely. I've been told by friends in the intelligence community that for many years they've had a very, very large file on me, and so do other governments because of what I write about. And when I asked them about what should you do, they said, do nothing. Anything you do to evade it will simply make them think that you're up to something, and it'll be even worse. The reality is they listen to everything, not because they're interested in what you say to your mother on the phone. They're not. In fact, in the vast majority of cases, Jerry, no human will ever listen to that phone call. It's just if you happen to use particular addresses or names or a collection of names that might relate to a terrorist attack, then that's downloaded and listened to by someone else, a human, who will listen to it, laugh, and basically put it back in the system. But if you ever become of interest to them, let's say someday your son wants to apply to work for the FBI, or any other high security position, even in the military. They will then go back and look at the conversations, emails, internet surfing of all family members related to that particular person, of course, that person himself, and they will look at the phone calls and communications and financial transactions of his friends. And so it's not necessarily that they're at all interested in what you are saying or doing today, but at some point in the future, someone you know may become of interest as a potential criminal, a terrorist target, or, you know, you yourself may be in a position where they're curious about you. And all of this data is being recorded. Most people don't realize, but all emails are recorded and are kept. Google, for example, as the biggest search engine in the world today, it keeps about 7 million Google keeps about 7 million searches every day, and the number is rapidly going up as they're expanding. They keep them on file forever. Now, if you think about your internet searches, Jerry, if I know and can access your internet searches and your email and your phone calls, I will know you better than any of your friends, because your email and your internet searches will tell me your health interests, your financial interests, your interest in retirement or otherwise, in religion, in philosophy, in politics. And the truth of the matter is, our internet searches and our emails, together with our phone calls, absolutely take away every vestige of privacy you've ever imagined you have.
You know, Grant, that's such a good point. And that's been one of the reasons why I've been so hesitant with Facebook. You know, Facebook is a social networking site that, you know, people share their entire personal lives on the web. People at Facebook know who all of your friends are. They know what you like. They know your personal calendar. Everything that you give them stays with them, too. People who have tried to shut down their account with Facebook find that they can simply log back in, and there it is. It stays on their servers forever.
Well, one of the things I warn in seminars, as well as in the book, Jerry, is that anything you put on the internet, everything you put on emails, or on one of these social networks like Facebook or Twitter, is there forever. I give the hypothetical example of a young girl, 16 years old, and she goes out Christmas and has a whirlwind romance with a college senior who's, you know, 4 or 5 years older than her, and she tells her 200 best friends on Facebook that, you know, she had a wonderful romance, her first sexual experience. A little later, a few years later, she kind of wishes she hadn't put all that out there, but anyway, she finds, as you said, you can't get rid of it. Now she goes for the dream job coming out of college. She's on the short list for a job she just loves and is perfectly prepared for. And just before her final interview, she receives a call saying, "I'm sorry, we can't use you." Unknown to her, the human resources of that company did a final search on the internet, and their people were able to access all of this information of illegal drug activity. The young man might even be found guilty of underage sex with a girl under 16 with more than 4 years difference between the two. All sorts of terrible consequences. Later, she finds a wonderful guy that she is really looking forward to marrying, and his parents, as many parents now do a background search of who is dating their children. And again, these detective agencies go back and look at this stuff and can compile a record of all the information you've ever put on the internet, including emails and especially the social networking. I recommend to young people who unfortunately do not have a well-developed sense of privacy, they really don't seem to worry about it the way you and I might, I suggest that they never write anything on the internet that they are not prepared to have a policeman standing over their shoulder watching what they're doing.
All right, Grant, there was something else you talked about in your book. It's called this radio frequency identification. It's this RFID. And I remember, several years ago, back whenever I was in Tulsa, Tulsa actually had a Walmart, one of the biggest ones in the country, ironically, and they began this test pilot market with these RFIDs, these little itty-bitty pieces of these little ID chips that were about the size of a grain of rice, or maybe even smaller. And they would actually implant these things into Gillette razors. And that way they were able to track, and it was for, you know, supply chain purposes and whatnot, whatever they said it was for. And it was a test pilot. Now, even down here in Houston where I live now, there are children who go to public schools down here where they actually have to get a issued ID card from the school that has an RFID chip in it, which is, enables them to be tracked. Yeah, this type of technology seems to be evolving. Now it's in many other things as well now. Talk about the impact of RFID and how it's being used by the shadow government.
Well, RFID chips are now universal. They're in every country of the world. China has put RFID chips on every one of the internal passports of over 1.3 billion Chinese citizens. In many countries, you cannot escape them. The reason they were started is, remember the old barcode? Well, by 1997, it was becoming really out of date and obsolete. It could only hold enough information for about 100,000 companies, and there are millions of companies in the world. And so many of these large consumer companies like Gillette and Procter & Gamble went to MIT University in Boston, and they asked them to come up with a replacement. They said, we want something that can hold vastly more memory, up to 1 million different companies, each with at least 1 million products. And they said, in addition, we want it to be so small that it's innocuous and invisible. Next, we want it to basically be very, very inexpensive, and that it can be read up to maybe 100 feet away with a radio frequency reader the size of a flashlight. Well, they came up with it. The first ones were the size of a large postage stamp. But now, 90% of them are the size of a period at the end of a printed sentence in your newspaper. In other words, they're virtually invisible. I can tell you that the average listener to this program has between 3 and 5 RFID chips on their body and their clothes right now. They're in the soles of your shoes. They're in the belt you are wearing. They're in the labels of your underwear and your shirt and your pants. They're built into the pen you use. And they're built into medicine bottles from your pharmacy. Many food products have them. The Department of Agriculture wants to monitor food from the time it is created until it ends up as a steak. And they want to monitor the whole food chain so that they can monitor for mad cow disease and other things. Now, the companies initially wanted it for inventory control, as you suggested, Jerry. And they also wanted it for anti-counterfeiting. 20% of luxury goods in this world are counterfeit. But by putting an invisible RFID chip in genuine luggage that is made by one of the top companies, then at a glance from 100 feet away, they can verify whether or not the chip is there. And the chip contains a number, a 96-digit alphanumeric number that is unique to that particular product. What they did is they supplied a 3-digit number, first of all, for the country of manufacture, probably China, then to the company that made it, then to the retailer that sold it, then a number of other numbers in the 96 digits include the type of product it is, say a pair of shoes, and then that they're hush puppy shoes, and their particular number for each shoe. Now, when they put them on the shelf and someone walks into a Walmart or Costco and picks up those shoes and goes to the cash register, instantly the inventory system reorders. And so it's a very efficient system, and it's not a trouble. The problem is, while they could have made the chips so they went dead when you passed the cash register, they didn't. Which means that once you are walking out the street, and you walk into a place with monitors like an airport, a bank, over 10,000 banks now have monitors, scanners built into their doors and into their floors. When you walk into your bank, those numbers, because you went and paid for it with your debit or credit card, now know that it's Grant Jeffrey who's walked into that bank. And though that teller is on her first day on the job, she can look up and say, hello, Mr. Jeffrey, how's your wife Kay doing? She can act like my best friend, and she doesn't even know me, because on her computer has come all of that data, including my accounts, my balances, and we have literally given up our privacy and our freedom, and no one ever debated this in Congress or in the Canadian or British Parliament. We have never had any laws that govern how this data can be used. And it isn't only the company like Walmart that can actually monitor that. Anyone with an RFID chip can literally drive down the street and point it to people, and they can read some of their credit cards because those credit cards are chipped. The euro, the European currency, the euro, now is issued with an invisible RFID chip in the currency. So literally in Europe, a crook could go down the street and he knows who has $5,000 worth of euros in his pocket. No debate was ever done. No laws have ever provided privacy protection. And so we have a situation today where about 3 billion chips are created every year around the world, and there's estimated that approximately 10 billion chips are already out there. They're in the Canadian and American passports. When you drive up to a border station in Canada or Mexico, that immigration officer literally, from the reader of the RFID reader, on her screen comes up that this is Grant Jeffrey. And when she leans out the window and says with a smile, "And where were you born?" she knows what the answer should be. And if you don't give that answer, then you're going in for a secondary investigation.
Well, this is something we've been talking about on our program for some time. We are tracked, we are traced, we are databased like cattle. And this is just more proof of where everything seems to be heading. And, you know, I can see how the technology itself could be proven useful. Obviously, it's extremely useful for companies and for obviously for government. But this is the concern that you obviously point at in your book, is that this type of technology provides way too much power, way too much control over a population that is, in essence, ignorant of the desires of those who are governing them. And so what I want to ask you here is that let's talk about some of the names, and maybe not just the names, but the name of the organizations. Who is behind the shadow government? Name some of the organizations that are desiring global governance, and what should our audience know about them?
Well, the largest of all, of course, is the United Nations. And the United Nations openly declares that they want to see the transition from national sovereignty into a truly global government. And the way they are doing it, they realize they have a very difficult obstacle in the way that the U.S. Constitution was created by very brilliant gentlemen who made it actually very difficult to amend. And without amending the U.S. Constitution, it was designed to keep America out of European wars and European entanglements, etc. But the lawyers that are moving toward world government found that international treaties signed by the president and 67-plus senators actually take precedence over the U.S. Constitution if there is a conflict. For example, in 1995, President Clinton and a majority of Congress signed the World Trade Organization. This 2,000-page treaty literally took away America's economic sovereignty. Now, about 200 nations, the majority of which do not share our aspirations for freedom politically, economically, religiously, and do not admire free enterprise, they are in the majority, and America has the same voting power as Uganda or Haiti. In this treaty, only one single senator actually read the treaty, and he voted against it. The other 99 senators, they read a one- or two-page summary prepared by their staff, and they voted for it. This treaty took America into one significant aspect of world government, where America was no longer free to exercise its sovereign independence to, for example, enact trade restrictions on China if they were dumping products inside America. That kind of thing is no longer possible. Well, the Kyoto Treaty is another example, signed in 1997. That treaty is a treaty that compels all the participants, including America, to actually reduce their carbon dioxide emissions up to 90% less than they were in 1990. Now, that is staggering because scientists who have examined this and economists have stated that this would mean reducing the standard of living of the American citizens back to pre-depression levels. No one's talking about that. They're all just talking about, well, we have to do something to save the planet. But here's a treaty that literally goes against the economic and political independence interest of the average American citizen who loves their country and loves their constitution, and basically puts it in the hands of people who do not share that. There are three major groups beside the UN, private groups, by invitation only, who are pushing for world government. The most important and the smallest is called the Bilderberger. They actually call themselves the Alliance. It's about 100 to 150 members who meet once or twice yearly at a highly secure facility, more security than the president has. And these billionaires, heads of multinationals, some royalty, these individuals openly indicate their desire to achieve global government. Now, one of the problems they're faced with is America is too powerful politically, militarily, and economically. America spends as much as the next 15 nations on the military. America is unchallengeable militarily with its high tech and its ability to project power and hours anywhere in the world. And therefore, one of the things they feel they must do, those individuals, American and otherwise, who want global government, they have to reduce the economic and political and military power of America. In other words, they can't shoehorn America into global government unless its economy is brought down to a fraction of what it is today. Many of the policies that are being followed by the government are in fact bringing America to a position of massive unemployment with environmental green regulations by the Environmental Protection Agency and by various other laws that are causing massive unemployment and are exporting jobs to other countries. And when you look at it, you think, are these people stupid? The answer is no. They actually have an agenda, and they are purposeful in what they want to achieve. Now, it's not because they're just really nasty people, although they are greedy for money and power, but they do believe that global government is inevitable, and they believe that sooner is better. And so these people, believing that with 200 nations and weapons of mass destruction available to at least 20 of those nations, that inevitably there will be a third world war, which will make the survivors envy the dead. They believe the only way to avoid a third world war that would be so disastrous is to have one global government so that there is not a possibility of one nation state going to war with another. The second group is the Council of Foreign Relations, primarily American, with about 3,300 members. Every member of the Obama administration of any significance is a member of one of these groups. In fact, in the 2008 election, in the summer, the Bilderbergers met in Chantilly, Virginia. Two individuals who were in the political race for president were given an invitation, and they came secretly. It included Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Everyone knew one of those was going to become president. So here are two people running for president of the United States, and they're going to meet with people secretly who want to abolish the U.S. Constitution and abolish the sovereign independence of the United States. The third group is called the Trilateral Commission, with representatives, a few hundred, about 300, and they're from the East, from Japan and China, Taiwan and South Korea, and then you have the North American contingent and the European contingent. All three believe global government and a very socialistic economy is the way to go.
As we go forward, Grant, I think the listeners to our program are wondering, what does this portend to them? With the economy obviously right now teetering on the edge, we've been through some massive problems the last couple of years. And now, as we go forward, what should listeners to this program and what should people in general be doing to protect themselves from what you see coming? Because I would imagine that if a global government comes into play, what you envision is going to be very different from what we currently have. No or yes?
Absolutely. It's going to be very different. I have a background as a financial planner for 20 years before I became a writer and communicator. And I believe that in a time of uncertainty, and we are definitely in a time of uncertainty, the value of the U.S. dollar is plummeting. America's position for the last 70 years as the world reserve currency has been very, very helpful to America, and it's about to be lost because America has been purposely devaluing its currency by creating trillions of dollars out of thin air, borrowing from everyone around the world, and even borrowing from themselves in a bizarre situation where the Federal Reserve, a private bank, actually creates money out of thin air. $600 billion is what they're now creating, and they're turning around and buying U.S. treasuries with it. Well, this is so Alice in Wonderland that it just makes the rest of the world very reluctant to invest in U.S. treasuries. China used to have about $1 trillion of U.S. treasuries, and now they are gradually not rolling them over when they come up for renewal. They are getting their money out. And China and Japan, the European Union, are calling for the creation of a new world reserve currency. So the American dollar goes down. The value of gold and silver continues to go up again and again. And gold has had the best return, far better than the stock market or any other commodity, over the last 10 years. And so that's one of the things I would do. I think we need to be conservative, Jerry. Samuel Johnson was a brilliant individual a couple centuries ago, and he made one statement that as a financial planner I absolutely admire, and he said, whatever you have, spend less. Unfortunately, Americans and Canadians, I'm a Canadian, have in fact spent more than they've been earning, and the levels of debt are crushing not only the government, but individuals. Get out of debt as quickly as you can. If you are able to prepay on your mortgage and get that mortgage out of there, the day you have no mortgage will be one of the happiest days in your life. It represents financial freedom. And so I think we need to rethink our investments, make sure we have a sufficient amount invested either directly in physical gold and silver bullion or indirectly in the form of mutual funds invested in resource companies that are based on that, because their track record has been absolutely exemplary in the last 10 years, and it should do even better going forward.
Fantastic. Our guest has been Grant Jeffery. Grant, if our listeners would like to learn more about you and your work, how can they do so?
Well, our website is called grantjeffery.com. That's one word, grantjeffery.com. I have 27 books, and they're available for order on the website together with DVDs of my television program. Basically, all the Christian bookstores and secular bookstores carry my Shadow Government book. I believe the essential thing right now is to, first of all, tell your political representatives you do not want global government. You want your country to stay as it is, and that you also want a law to protect privacy, especially as it regards radio frequency ID chips.
Fantastic, Grant. Thank you so much for your time. We'll look forward to having you back on. You have another book that's very interesting to me that I want to have you back on soon, so we'll look forward to that in the future.
Thanks so much. God bless.